Well, good morning. Thank you very much for the invitation, and thanks to all the speakers for giving such nice talks. I very much enjoyed this conference. So today I want to talk about work concerning the following initial value problem, and I'll put this up so you can see it. And X is in the two-dimensional torus. So this is a nonlinear Schrodinger equation. And the main question that I'm interested in is, for very, very nice data, I'd like to understand the behavior of some norm like this. So this is not an issue in low regularity. This is an issue in what happens on classical solutions. So first I'll introduce the problem, and I'll give a quick overview of, and I'll state the main result. Then I'll give a quick overview of the principal steps in the discussion of an answer to this question. And then I'll talk briefly about two of the main components in the proof, namely Arnold diffusion for a certain ordinary differential equation embedded in this infinite dimensional dynamical system. And finally, I'll talk about the construction of that ordinary differential equation. So this is joint work with Mark Kiel, Giliola Staffolani, Hideo Takaoka, and Terence Tao. So we are considering this nonlinear Schrodinger equation, and I guess to be consistent, I should put a minus sign here. It's defocusing, and we're considering the two-dimensional periodic problem, and at times I'll make reference to the problem posed on the plane as well. As this problem evolves in time for nice data, there are these two quantities, the mass, which is just the L2 norm, and the energy, which remain invariant with time. So the dynamics are taking place on a sphere in L2 and on some sort of a surface inside of H1, which is expressed by conservation of the energy. And that imposes certain constraints on the solution. For example, the fact that we have conservation of energy means that the H1 norm cannot diverge to infinity. It's constrained by the value of the energy initially. It can change a little bit by sharing a little bit with this L4 norm. Meanwhile, the L2 norm does not change as a function of time. So if you extrapolate naively, you might think that that norm is bounded, since between 0 and 1, nothing changes. Maybe the same thing's true for all S. But what this question is really asking is, we'd like to understand the shape of the L2 density as a function of time. So we start off with something localized near the zero frequency, maybe a few modes are excited, and then when the sine function is squared, it excites sine 2x, and when that is squared, it excites sine 4x. We've got this nonlinear interaction. It might be the case that that squaring process of the nonlinearity leads to a shift of this Fourier density towards higher and higher frequencies, or maybe not. And that's the question we want to understand. So this is an example of an infinite dimensional dynamical system. And of course, in an infinite dimensional dynamical system, perhaps it's not so surprising that you can embed many interesting finite dimensional dynamical systems. But since this is truly infinite dimensional, we would like to understand what phenomena in this infinite dimensional dynamical system are there that are truly infinite dimensional. So if I change the sign of the nonlinearity, then it becomes the focusing problem, and there's a rich infinite dimensional dynamic, namely the process of singularity formation, where the wave compresses to arbitrarily small spatial scales. I'm not interested in that phenomena in this talk. I'm interested in the phenomena where we explore arbitrarily large frequencies. The oscillations grow faster and faster, and we explore small spatial scales due to this nonlinear upconversion phenomena. So the phenomena of weak turbulence is this idea that through nonlinear upconversion, you might have the mass move from low frequencies to arbitrarily high frequencies. It's sometimes called a forward cascade in the fluids literature. And one way to measure this phenomena is to try to understand the behavior of high Sobolev norms and to prove that this grows for large times. So in this family of problems, nonlinear Schrodinger equations, especially in RD, there are asymptotic descriptions, like in Alex Yosevich's talk, of the final state behavior of solutions in some cases. Turbulence, or this phenomena, is incompatible with scattering, and also it's incompatible with complete integrability. So what's the phenomena of scattering? The phenomenon of scattering says that the long-time behavior is somehow described by the associated linear evolution. I'm seeing comical smiles. Did I make a joke? Or? Yeah, sorry. You're sitting right there, yeah. And Tatiana Toronto will also like that joke. Where's Steve? All right, I'm making jokes. Okay. So, yeah, I know. So it could be that you have the nonlinear evolution behaving asymptotically in time like a reference linear evolution. If that were the case, then the nonlinear solution should display the same long-time asymptotic behavior as the linear solution in Sobolev norms, and this linear reference evolution is essentially just spinning around Fourier modes, so the HS norm would not change as a function of time. So if we have this H1 million or H10,000 norm explode, then the nonlinear evolution is doing something truly nonlinear, something different from the linear evolution. If I collapse in the dimension from the two-dimensional problem to the one-dimensional problem, then this equation is called the Zakharov-Shabbat system, and it is completely integrable. And based on this complete integrability, one can identify an infinite number of conservation laws, and using those conservation laws, you can prove an a priori upper bound on any Sobolev norm, which is initially finite. So the completely integrable behavior is inconsistent with this turbulent behavior. Yes? That's true. But if I have asymptotic in time behavior that looks linear, all I'm trying to say is that this phenomena can't take place. But you're absolutely right. I mean, I'm not reporting that anything like this is known in the context of the periodic problem, but we saw hints of it in Barak's talk, that there's something like this linear behavior on long time intervals in the 1D case. So past results in the direction of this question, there's a extensive literature in physics that I'll mention briefly in a moment, but let me mention some rigorous results. So Borgon in the late 1990s was studying this question, and he proved polynomial in time upper bounds, and that's a substantial improvement over the trivial estimates that one can obtain from the local theory directly by essentially iterating the local well-posedness result. So from the local well-posedness result, one has this first equation appearing in red here. Okay. This first equation in red for a time interval which is determined by, let's say, the H1 norm. And now if you just iterate that, you're going to get exponential doubling, or exponential upper bounds at least, on the growth of the Sobolev norm. And what Borgon managed to do was to improve on that first estimate in red and obtain instead, thank you very much, this second estimate in red here. And so notice the constant 1. Instead of experiencing the doubling of this constant, C, C squared, C cubed, and so forth, one has a 1 here with a small error, and this error is quantified with this delta, and if you iterate this over these time intervals of fixed length, one obtains a polynomial in time upper bound, and then there's been a various race to push exponents and so forth, and so this 4S has been lowered in subsequent work by Staffolani and then in work with Delore, Koenig, and Staffolani. So, if the HS norm explodes, it explodes at most at a polynomial in time rate, and we can sometimes lower the degree. In the setting of the wave equation, there's a metric, or a metric Laplacian, with solutions which Borgon can construct that shows a polynomial in time explosion in S, in the HS norm. So there's a literature in physics, starting from work in the 60s by Hasselmann and further developed by Zakharov and collaborators in a vast literature. And it's been energized recently in work by Maida McLaughlin and Tabak and corresponding work by Zakharov and collaborators, where they've introduced certain one-dimensional models having dispersive functions that look like this, as opposed to dispersive functions that look like the paraboloid. And there's this one-dimensional aspect of the problem enables them to do numerics. And there's a rich statistical theory of this phenomena, a statistical theory of the initial value problem. And connections between the rigorous work of Borgon and the work that I'm trying to understand or describe to you at least, with this applied mathematics literature, I think need to be further explored. So based on this physics background and other sources, the conjecture seems to be that if you have a problem on RD, you have scattering phenomena, or perhaps you have some solitons. I'm restricting myself to the situation where we do not have finite time blow up. There is some sort of long time asymptotic behavior, but the behavior does not involve arbitrary in time growth of high Sobolev norms in the RD case. But in the situation of compact domains, for example on the torus, you've got this wave that keeps interacting with itself. It doesn't have any room at spatial infinity to disperse away, and that continued interaction means that sine keeps squaring with sine, and then sine 2x keeps squaring with sine 2x, and so forth. And so the expectation is that you do have this growth when you're on compact domains. So here's the main result that I want to report on today, is that for this problem, that should be a capital K, if you take a big S, there exists initial data. U naught, which is small, say big O of 1, initially, and there exists a time, perhaps very far in the future, when the HS norm is bigger than your target. Yes, I made two mistakes. They weren't commuting, though. So this K should be the same as that K. This T should be the same as that T. Thank you. So I am not asserting that it goes to infinity. I'm only asserting that it goes past any threshold that you can pick. And I'm not asserting what happens after that time capital T. It may very well come back down. Okay? So it's very weak turbulence, but it is at least something consistent with this conjecture that one does have explosive growth. So let me give you an overview of the proof. So we will first perform a reduction, which is exactly the same reduction that was discussed in Barak's talk. We will take the original NLS equation and make some sort of a gauge transformation to obtain, which will involve the exact same formulas as in Barak's talk, and obtain an ODE version of NLS, which I will call Fourier NLS. This is entirely equivalent. We'll then project Fourier NLS onto the resonant part of Fourier NLS. That's still going to be an infinite dimensional ordinary differential equation, or equivalently a PDE, expressed in Fourier coordinates. It will look like an infinite dimensional ODE. We will then choose some set, which I'm going to call lambda, but because I'm graphically challenged, I have to write subscript L. And this RF NLS will project down to a finite dimensional ordinary differential equation on a very well-chosen set lambda. This well-chosen set lambda will collapse further to a really nice ODE, which we call the toy model ODE. Now, this ODE, we will show, has the phenomena of Arnold diffusion. And the Arnold diffusion effect in the toy model ODE will imply the theorem for NLS, and there is an approximation result which links this toy model ODE back to the original equation, provided you have data that's supported on this set L and some other statements. What I will emphasize in this talk is some aspects of this step and some aspects of this step. This step here is pretty straightforward and more standard. Okay. So first, if we take this equation and we multiply by a phase, then we can manufacture a new term on the right-hand side depending on this constant, capital G. So there's nothing to this. You just multiply by e to the minus 2gt and you crank it out. And the time derivative sometimes falls here, and when it does, it's going to create that constant. So I now have this parameter that I can play with. Now let's make a full ansatz. Let's suppose that I have a solution which I write in this form. Of course, this is entirely full. I mean, I can write any function defined in xt in this way, but I have these t-dependent Fourier coefficients, a sub n of t. If I take this form of u, or v, I should say, right here, and substitute it in, I can re-express these dynamics on the Fourier transform side. And the hard part is that I'm going to have to expand out this nonlinear term with respect to all of these exponentials. And there emerges this parameter omega 4, which I have to define. Omega 4 also appeared in Barak's talk, and it's n1 squared minus n2 squared plus n3 squared minus n4 squared. And that's from combining all of those oscillations, e to the I n squared t, which come from the Laplacian and the linear equation. Okay. Now, this sum that you saw in the previous step here, it involves this convolution constraint, and what I'm going to do now is break it up into subsums. First, I have the full thing, and I can break it up under these conditions, but I double count, so I have to cancel something away. So this one and this one, I'm going to double count, so I have to take that part away. Now, this term and this term, just like in Barak's talk, can be calculated and spawn the L2 norm. And those terms can be canceled if you make the choice of G. So what I'm saying here is that I'm removing the nonlinear interaction, which is accounted for by two of the factors becoming the L2 norm. In some sense, it's an interaction with the zero frequency. Those terms I can completely take away by this gauge transformation. And what's left is no sum at all. That's just the self-interaction, AN, AN bar, AN. And then another term. So at the end of the day, this problem can be fully recast like this, where I have removed these interactions with the L2 norm part of the nonlinearity, and what remains is this non-self-interaction region, gamma of n. Now, inside of gamma of n, I can look for choices of triples for a given n which kill omega 4. Now, those are the objects up here which will not have time oscillation. There will be no oscillation. So that in principle, when I integrate up this AN with respect to time, there won't be any stationary phase helping me to control this expression. So that should probably be a pretty big contribution to the nonlinearity. That's the so-called resonant part of the nonlinear interaction. So let's look then, given an N, at those triples, N1, N2, N3, which kill this phase omega 4. So playing around with this Pythagorean-like relationship, one can justify that omega 4 is killed when N, N1, N2, N3 form an ordered rectangle in the lattice. So now we have a geometrical way of understanding when we have resonance. And we can now try to organize things based on this resonant decomposition with the geometry. So now what I'll do is I'll take this equation, and I'll collapse the interaction to include only those resonant interactions. And in some sense, I expect intuitively that the other parts involving omega 4 should probably not contribute much to my nonlinear dynamics, because when I time integrate them, I have all of this oscillation that should help me out. One hopes. Okay, now let's suppose that I have a set lambda sitting inside the plane. I will say that this set is closed under resonant interaction if it has the following property. If you've got a triple which forms with N an ordered rectangle, then if N1, N2, and N3 are in this subset, then this other point N must also be in that set. So whenever I have a triple, the fourth point on the rectangle is also in my set. And I will say that my set is closed under this resonance. Then a finite dimensional resonant truncation of that Fourier analog of NLS is the resonant truncation that I had before, but then I'll collapse it further and I'll only look at subsets which have this resonant closed property. And this is just some ODE sitting inside of the resonant truncation of my full infinite dimensional ODE analog of my PDE. Now, this is just an ODE, and one can also prove by a Gromov type argument that if you have the support initially contained in one of these sets closed under resonant interaction, then this evolution is nicely approximated by the preceding ODE. So when we collapse things to the resonant case, if we have the support contained in a closed resonant set, then the full evolution is nicely approximated by this evolution. And I'm being imprecise, but I'm asserting that we have a good approximation result using sort of standard tools. Now, what I want to do is find a lambda so that this ODE has the behavior that implies this Sobolev norm growth behavior. Now imagine that we build a set lambda that has every dreaming property that I need. Whether or not I can pull this off remains to be seen, but let's just postpone that concern and join with me in this hopeful thought that I can build a set having some very dreamy properties. Suppose that I can build a resonant closed subset of Z2 lambda, which decomposes into lambda 1 through lambda m, which I will call generations. So there's the first generation lambda 1. It will spawn the second generation lambda 2, all the way down the line. So this civilization lambda consists of capital M generations with the following properties. We have a nuclear family. It's a rectangle, N1, N2, N3, N4. The N1 and N3 are the parents, and they live in the generation lambda j. And they spawn, in some sense, N2, N4, which are in lambda j plus 1. The children live in the next generation. We have lots of nice uniqueness properties that go by way of this civilization, generation, family analogy. So for 1 less than or equal to j less than m, if you have an N1 in lambda j, then it has a unique spouse, and it has a unique pair of children, N2 and N4. If you have a child, it has a unique partner child, N4, and it has unique parents, N1 and N3. The sibling of a frequency is never its spouse. Besides nuclear families, this set lambda contains no other rectangles. And finally, the function n goes to an of 0 is going to be constant on each generation lambda j. So the value that I'm going to put on my frequencies is going to be constant initially all the way across any one generation. Whether or not I can build this set remains to be seen. Let's just suppose that I did, and now let's look back at that ODE on such a set lambda, and we will then have some collapsing of that ODE. But before I do that, let me give you a cartoon of what the set might look like if you imagine it. Okay, so here's Z2. Imagine that I place these four parents down, and these two parents decide to get together and spawn children. Now this new generation, now notice, this child landed at the origin, and you can't really see the difference in colors. They're supposed to be red, and then the next ones are orange, and I'm going to walk through the rainbow. Okay, so these orange children were spawned by the interaction of these two parents. Okay, and now I populate with the interactions among all the parents, and now you'll notice that there's a four-tuple of points that are overlapping at the origin, which is not something I want ultimately, but let's ignore that issue for the moment. Now, in this next generation, the first generation of children, we have two parents that are now parents. They interact, and they spawn two children. And now I've got four orange and one green sitting at the origin. And now I have the whole generation of these greens, and similarly. Okay? So that's some cartoon of the type of structure that I'm imagining sitting inside of the plane. We'll assume that we can build this thing. Then, if you take those structural properties and you go back to the resonant FNLS ODE collapsed to this set, then the only interactions are between generations and within generation. So you get this collapsed ODE, and you might not see it, but if you squint at it, you might think there's some sort of traveling wave behavior here. Now, on this ODE, you can revisit the conservation laws. The L2 norm can be expressed this way, the HS norm can be expressed this way, and we're going to also want this lambda to satisfy the wide diaspora property, so that the generations go far out into the plane. They move far from their parents. There's an overachiever that goes far, there's an underachiever that goes to the origin. And these overachievers always have new overachievers that go further and further and further out, so that eventually, the span of the nth generation, measured in this moment sense, is far from where they were originally. Now, the conservation laws can be expressed back on this ODE, but something really interesting happens on the ODE that's different from the conservation laws on the full PDE. On the full PDE, we have the H1 norm. Now, the H1 norm is a moment norm on the Fourier transform side, so it costs a lot to move frequencies to high frequencies. You have to pay by increasing the energy. But the dynamics of this PDE are such that the H1 norm is bounded. So I can't just go willy-nilly moving my mass towards high frequencies without violating energy conservation. But on this ODE, sitting inside of this PDE, the mass, momentum, which is another conserved quantity I didn't mention before, and the energy can all be expressed in terms of expressions involving the BJs alone without weights depending upon J. And now, on this ODE, there's a chance that I can move my mass around while keeping the energy constant, the momentum constant, and maybe I can push things out towards high frequencies so that if I go back to this wide diaspora property, I'm going to get a bang on the HS part, on the HS norm. Okay? Okay, so here's the idea. These are generations. And what we want to do is build initial data, which is concentrated on j equals 3. Okay, I could do to j equals 1, but because of technical issues near the boundary, j equals 0, let's ignore that. Okay, I've got most of my math concentrated in generation 3. Okay, those are the values of the Fourier transform on the points inside of lambda 3. So there's a lot of mass there. But in the other generations, I've got a little bit. Okay, there's epsilon distributed elsewhere. Now, at time t equals 0, everything's here. But then later, it all moves to the highest generation, m minus 2. If I can pull that off, then because of the diaspora property, this will have a much bigger HS norm than it did initially, and I'll be something in the direction of the statement of the theorem. So we're going to make a traveling wave that moves through these generations in this decomposition of the partial differential equation. Okay, so let me see how this goes. So what is the solution of this toy model equation, this collapsed version of the resonant nonlinear Schrodinger equation, ODE, to this special civilization lambda? Well, it's a vector flow, B1 of t all the way up to Bm of t, and local opposence of this is trivial. We have mass conservation, so this vector doesn't change length in L2. And what this mass conservation property of this vector means is that the sphere inside Cm is invariant. So that's saying that the dynamics take place on a sphere. We know that about the PDE, but now if I collapse this ODE to a finite dimensional sphere, the dynamics are going to take place on this finite dimensional sphere. Okay. Now we also have support conservation. So that if I take the time derivative of bj squared, I can calculate that from the ODE, and then using some Grandval ideas, basically I get to here. Now suppose that bj is initially zero, then by Grandval it will forever be zero. So the support is conserved. In particular, points that have zero initially stay zero forever. Now this is nice because now I can talk about invariance of coordinate tori. Suppose that I look at b1 through bm inside of this sphere that's invariant, and I consider bj equal to 1 for some j and bk equal to 0 everywhere else. So where is bj living? It's living on a circle in the jth coordinate plane inside of cm minus 1. Then all of these bks are 0 initially, so they will forever be 0 because of this Grandval property. And now the dynamics of this ODE, they're not only preserving this sphere, they're preserving the coordinate circles. Okay, so mass conservation, because everything's concentrated in this one place, implies S of T, Tj equals Tj, so I have circles inside of my sphere which remain invariant under the flow. Now the dynamics on these tori is easy, it's just basically you go around. Well, let's suppose that I have M equals 2, and I look at this ODE and I collapse this ODE, then there's an explicit solution, which we call the slider. So the slider at time minus infinity looks like the periodic thing going around the first circle. And if I wait infinitely long, it eventually moves from the first circle onto the second circle. So I can move from coordinate plane 1 circle over to coordinate 2 circle, but it takes me an infinite amount of time to get there. So what does this look like? I've got something going around this circle. This is sort of a bad picture. I think this picture should actually have two separate circles because I'm looking at something in at least four dimensions. These circles don't actually intersect. Right, but I've got something going around this coordinate plane. At minus infinity, it's exactly on that coordinate plane circle. And then if I go forward in time, after a while, it does something transitory, but eventually it starts going around this other coordinate plane circle, and that's explicit. I have that. So we have two explicit solution families. We've got this periodic orbit, and we've got this transition from one of these to the other, and I'm getting graphically challenged. I couldn't get rid of that bar, but anyway. So the idea is to build concatenated sliders somehow, so that we start them interacting near the coordinate plane 3, and they move off to the coordinate plane 4, and so forth, using dynamical systems methods. So the Arnold diffusion statement for this particular toy model ODE is that there exists a choice of initial data, x3, so that the flow of this ODE moves x3 out to xm minus 2. It's that traveling wave statement. And S of Tx3 is initially concentrated very, very close to mod j equals 3, but because of the Grandval statement, it can't be entirely concentrated there. I need a little bit elsewhere to kind of move it along, and eventually it moves along. is the statement. Okay, so there are lots of analogies with our proof of this statement with the famous theorem of Arnold. But we had to use some different notions. So one of them, the two main notions that help us to prove this are what are called targets and covering. So let's suppose we have an origin point O sitting inside of some phase space and some destination point D. Then we would like to flow from near O to near D. So this is somehow near the point X3, and we want to go over to this point XM-2. The notion of target quantifies this question. So let me build this notion. Let's suppose that we have M denote a subset of my invariant sphere sigma, and let D be a metric on sigma, and let R be some radius. Then the target, MDR, are those points X inside the sphere which are within distance R of my set M. That should have been a different font. Given two points X, Y in the sphere, we will say X hits Y if you can flow from X along the ODE and land on Y. So if you can flow, the flow out goes to the point Y. So the notion of covering includes this surjective notion that you expect, but it also includes something a little bit stronger, which is a statement of stability. So suppose that we have an initial target and a final target, then we say that M1, D1, R1 can cover M2, D2, R2, and we write M1, D1, R1 goes to M2, D2, R2, or covers M2, D2, R2, if we have this. For any point X2 inside of M2, I can find a backwards pre-image so that nearby the backwards pre-image, I can get to nearby the target point. And these R's quantify the stability properties of the flow. It's not just the surjectivity statement. The R1 and R2 also quantify how close I get to the target point. Okay. So one can prove transitivity of covering. If this target covers that target, and that target covers the next target, then the first target covers the last target, because you can flow in and then flow on. So what we're going to do is near these explicit solutions on TJ, we're going to construct three targets. An incoming target, a ricochet target, and an outgoing target. And we're going to make it so that the incoming target covers the ricochet target, the ricochet target covers the outgoing target, and then we have a transition that the outgoing target goes into the, there should be minus signs here, the incoming target on the next one. So here's the picture. We've got an incoming target, some sort of rattling around, ricochet target around this thing, and then an outgoing target. And the task is to construct a finite set, oops, so then we concatenate these together. So before, when I had that picture with the circles with the arrows, we also have ricochet targets in between to actually pull it off. Okay, so that's sort of the scheme for proving the Arnold diffusion. Quantifying the targets is quite technical, and I can't pull that off in the last little bit. So that's first introduction, let's say, to the Arnold diffusion part. Now, how do we build this set lambda? Yeah, I gave you a picture, a cartoon version of the picture, and now let me briefly describe sort of how we actually build the set lambda to have these properties. Okay, we want to construct a finite set lambda satisfying those properties, those dreamy properties, the civilization, generation, nuclear family properties, and we're going to do it in two steps. First, we're going to build an abstract version of lambda, which we call sigma. So sigma now has a new meaning. In namespace, there's been a collision. Sigma is no longer the sphere. Sigma is something that will eventually map to lambda in this part of the talk. So sigma is sitting inside of CM-1. I'm eventually going to want to map sigma into lambda, which will be sitting inside of the lattice. So here's sort of the way it goes. The way that you localize yourself in a civilization is that you have to know all of the parents that were in your ancestry and all of your descendants in the future. That localizes you in a civilization. So we're going to build this generation, this collection, with that kind of information. You have to know all of this child's parents and grandparents and all of this child's progeny. So let's start with the unit square. So we have 1 plus I and 0, 1 and 0, and we separate it into S1 and S2. S1, 1i, S2 is 0, 1 plus I. And we're going to work inside of the Gaussian integers. with the usual identification. We define sigma j to be z1, z2 up to zm minus 1, so that z1 through zj minus 1 are all from this S2 set, where S2 is 0, 1 plus I, and so that all of the remaining ones, zj through zm minus 1, are in S1. It's kind of like precursors and progeny. Sigma j consists of S2 to the j minus 1 cross S1 to the m minus j, and all it is an m minus 1 tuple of points inside of C, so it's a point in Cm minus 1, and you can count these things because there's just a choice of two. We know how big sigma j is. Next, we define sigma to be the union of sigma 1 through sigma m, where I'm changing this breaking point inside of this list. Now, the number of elements inside of this abstract civilization is, of course, the number of generations times the number in each generation, and sigma j here is what I've been saying is called a generation. Now, let's consider the set F, which is F0, F1, F1 plus I, Fi, that's parameterized by the points in the standard unit square, and it's sitting inside of this set sigma, and it's defined as follows. These are its ancestors, these are its progeny, and among all the choices of W, we're going to get essentially that family. The elements are called children if they're in sigma j plus 1, and the elements F1 and Fi are called the parents. So inside of FW, we've got two parents and two children, and they form a nuclear family linked across this generation J. Okay, so this four-element set F, parameterized by the unit square, with the first J minus 1 slots fixed and J plus 1 through N fixed, are a combinatorial nuclear family connecting these two generations at that slot J. Now you can count how many nuclear families there are connecting generations sigma J and sigma J plus 1. It's just some discrete math. And you can also see that the way this has been constructed, we have the existence and uniqueness and no incest properties. Okay. So next we need to somehow map this abstract version of lambda called sigma, which is sitting inside of Cm minus 1, into Z2 injectively. So to do that, we're going to define a placement function, which will be the map that's going to take sigma 1 to C, and we do that inductively. So for each generation and each combinatorial nuclear family, we're going to associate an angle, which is the angle of the rectangle. And we can now put parameters on these abstract families, which are associated with angle. We're going to maybe put them in this way. Or we can build extra parameters since we're trying to just define this map. So how are we going to do it? We have to do it in such a way that we maintain the desired orthogonality properties, but if we have the orthogonality properties, we can still rotate the target rectangle. Okay? So the claim is that because the Pythagorean angles are dense inside of the circle, and because the rational points are dense inside the plane, one can essentially do the construction inside of R2 injectively and then tweak it a little bit using some measure theory. Using those ideas, this is the theorem that we can get, which asserts that there is a good placement function satisfying the injectivity. It sits inside the Gaussian integers. It lies between, say, it lies in the dyadic, quote-unquote, shell of radius n, but with these huge constants, depending upon the number of generations. We have the faithfulness expectations that if you have x1, x2, and x3, which are in here, then there is, in fact, a fourth element inside of the range, which forms the fourth element of the nuclear family expressed by the rectangle x1, x2, x3, x4. And we build it in such a way that we have an explosion of the norm if we move from the first generation's image, f of c1, to the final image, f of cm. So now I want to make two remarks about the result. So the first remark is that what we're working on next is we've done this with one civilization. Now, in principle, what you can do, one hopes, is you can build a whole bunch of civilizations that are very, very disjoint. And you have this take place at some time t1, And then at some future time, T2, much, much farther than T1, the second civilization finally gets busy and moves its wave. And we do this many, many times with the hope that we can not only exceed any large constant, but we can go to infinity. Right? That's not done, but we hope that things are sort of non-interacting enough that we can build this to actually prove the conjecture. So that's the first remark. The second remark is, whenever you mention Arnold diffusion, there seems to be a lot of controversy. One of the main things about Arnold diffusion that's controversial is the famous footnote in Arnold's paper, which says that this phenomenon should be generic in nearly integrable Hamiltonian systems. Perturbations off of integrable Hamiltonian systems should have this phenomenon. What I think is an interesting remark is that this nonlinear Schrodinger equation is a ubiquitous model in wave propagation models. So if you give me some problem in physics that has wave propagation, then there's often a slowly varying amplitude solution that is well modeled by this PDE. So in some sense, this PDE is ubiquitous and relevant in a whole family of differential equations having wave behavior. So it's provocative, I guess, to wonder, if this PDE has this phenomena, and you have PDE showing up in approximations for a wide collection of wave equations, it might be that this weak turbulence phenomena is in fact generic and shows up in lots of other models. But that requires approximation results, and to show that these solutions actually remain stable under the perturbations between this and the physical model. Thanks a lot.